bum 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 bum, ring the bell, sucker. This is Movie Fighters. It's the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and we beat them up. We went back and forth on what we were going to watch for this January episode. But we said when we watched Pottersville last month for our holiday episode that we were going to need a palate cleanser, that we were going to need something to refresh and renew us, that we were going to need to do something to revitalize our spirits. We wanted to watch Around the World in 80 Days on Netflix, the Jackie Chan movie. It's not on Netflix anymore for reasons unknown to us. So, Chris, what did we decide to do instead?
This is how quickly this came together. The name of this file that we were recording is, I thought, very funny. I called it Jackie Chan Teen to celebrate a new year with our, honestly, the man I consider my Lord and Savior. Nothing but respect for my JC.
Sure.
When it was unavailable, we had to make some quick choices. And a few days ago, I was sitting on the couch and Aiden was making dinner. And she was like, hey, what do you want to watch while we eat? And I said, well, honey, getting married was the best decision I ever made. But I will say, if I was single, there is a lot on Amazon Prime, a service that is notoriously bad at having options for things to watch, that I would watch right now. And I pointed at the television, and what was on the television was Beastmaster.
Or, as it's known by its official title, The Beastmaster.
Yes, this is not Beastmaster or Ultimate Beastmaster, the weird Ninja Warrior-esque international competition game show that has commentary by Terry Crews that is on Netflix and is in its own way very delightful, but is unfortunately called Ultimate Beastmaster, which made me, and I think everyone, think that it was a continuity light reboot of the Beastmaster franchise about like a younger Dar who has a bad haircut.
This movie.
Oh, Matt, can I, wait, stop, stop. Matt, stop. Hit motherfucking pause. Because I just wanted to make sure that I knew when Beastmaster came out. So I just popped that bad boy into Wikipedia. And there's a disambiguation page. Did you know Beastmaster is a 1982 film loosely based on the novel?
I think I did know that. I think I did know that it was based on a book, but I didn't. I don't know anything about the book.
Well, the book is not a Conan ripoff as the movie is, it seems.
Okay.
It appears to be about a Native American former soldier named Hosteen Storm, who has a telepathic connection with a group of genetically altered animals. That is not what this movie is about at all.
The very loose adaptation, it sounds like.
Point two, yes. Do you know who directed this bad boy?
Yeah, it was Don Coscarelli.
Yes, our boy Don Coscarelli.
You may know Don Coscarelli from our lengthy discussions of the Phantasm series of movies.
Matt.
Yes.
A phantasm is the delusion of a disordered mind.
It's true. That is probably the series that Don Coscarelli is best known for, but he did direct the first of these Beastmaster movies. The sequels, I believe, he did not have anything to do with. Beastmaster 2 Through the Portal of Time was directed by Silvio Tablet, or Tabe.
Silvio Tablet is a very good name.
It's Tabe, it's not Tablet. And the third movie, Beastmaster 3, The Eye of Braxis.
You're talking about The Eye of Braxis?
Yeah, it was directed by Gabriel Beaumont.
If it was possible, with this bullshit movie streaming technology that we have found ourselves with here in the year of 2018, we would have gone straight to Beastmaster 2. Beastmaster 2 not only does not appear to be streaming, but I looked it up on Amazon, and the only way I can currently purchase it is on a VHS tape, which, to be fair, is exactly how you should purchase Beastmaster 2 Through the Portal of Time.
Beastmaster 3 also only available
on the Eye of Braxis.
Yes. Also only available on VHS. Not seemingly available on DVD. Here's some interesting stuff about August 19, 1982's Beastmaster. It had a budget of $9 million.
Okay, that's actually very funny to me.
Let's see what $9 million in 1982 dollars is. Only $22 million in 2018 money. So that is a low-budget movie.
How much of that do you think went directly to this dope-ass poster?
The poster is dope as shit.
Yeah, the poster is cool as hell. It's a ring with an eyeball in it, and then inside the ring there's Dar against a spectral eagle, and also he has a panther buddy, and also there's a sexy lady, because it's 1982 and this is a Conan ripoff.
And also the message, born with the courage of an eagle, the strength of a black tiger, and the power of a god.
It's the epic adventure of a new kind of hero, the Beastmaster.
Beastmaster made a total of $14 million at the box office, which would be about $35.5 million in current money. So it did turn a profit. But
yeah, it became a franchise.
Yes, but we're talking in terms of movies now, pretty low stakes money-wise.
Here's the best thing I've seen in my brief Google searching about Beastmaster. Because I looked at the poster, because the poster is cool as hell. The poster for Beastmaster 3, The Eye of Braxis, is not good at all. It's a bad, late 90s Photoshop job. But this particular poster is for the World Television premiere and has a sticker on it telling you to watch it on WTVT Tampa. Which, again, it's the perfect representation of the Beastmaster franchise, I believe.
Well, yeah, what we really ought to be doing instead of watching this on Amazon Prime is watching it on TBS.
Yeah, on the TBS or the Fox Movie Machine.
Yes. Do we really need to tell people, explain Beastmaster at all, or talk about our own personal histories with Beastmaster? We both just watched it a bunch when it was on TV.
Yeah, because it is one of those movies that seemed like it was on TV constantly. Because to its credit, it is a Conan ripoff, but is in some ways I think superior to the original Conan the Barbarian movie. It's not as well made, I don't think, and it certainly doesn't have the budget. But I think it's more fun in a lot of ways because it is about a dude who can talk to ferrets.
It does not bother with taking itself seriously at all.
No. There's a reason that Beastmaster 2, the direct sequel to this movie, it is about Dar driving a Corvette through a time portal to modern day Los Angeles.
Yes. Yes, very much so. We could talk briefly about the cast of this movie, I suppose. Mark Singer plays Dar. He played Dar in all three movies.
Uh-huh.
He's been in a lot of stuff since then. He's been, one of those reliable B-movie actors. Mm-hmm. Or I guess B-actors, because he's in a lot of TV shows and stuff, too. He's kind of like if Bruce Campbell hadn't made a brand out of Bruce Campbell.
If Bruce Campbell, if there was no irony to Bruce, you know what he is? He's Bruce Campbell if Don Coscarelli directed Army of Darkness instead of Sam Raimi. He's exactly that.
That is 1,000% correct. You might know Mark Singer best as the voice of the Man-Bat on Batman the Animated Series.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I did not actually know that. Was he also Kirk Langstrom, or was he just the Man-Bat?
He was both. He was Kirk Langstrom and the Man-Bat. He was also in a few episodes of Highlander, the series. But he's one of those actors who just pops up and stuff sometimes.
He also had a comics blog in the early 2000s.
Maybe the
that is a deep cut comics blog joke for anyone who's around in the early to mid 2000s comics blogosphere. When a gentleman named Mark Singer had a comics blog called Not the Beastmaster, because he was not the guy who played the Beastmaster.
Perhaps the most surprising name in the credits of this movie is Rip Torn. He was already a pretty well-established character actor by that point. Mm-hmm. By 1982, Rip Torn was Rip Torn as we know him now, more or less. So that he's kind of a surprising name to see in the credits here. Tanya Roberts, who plays
A View to a Kill.
She plays Kiri. She was in A View to a Kill. She's also done a lot of those like TV guest roles since then.
Dennis Miller has turned on us, Matt, as a people. But he did make a joke that a very good joke that HBO stood for Hey Beastmasters on, which is pretty accurate. And apparently it was second only to Gone with the Wind as the most popular movie to air on TNT, as said by a programming director in 1993.
I believe it.
Yeah. Well, they fucking showed it enough.
I don't think we need to say anything else. I think we just watched the movie.
Here's the thing. We could do the second half of the show where we recap the events of Beastmaster right now.
But it would be a TV edit of the movie.
It would include like, yeah, and then I turned it off and I played Super Mario Brothers 3 for a little while.
Yeah.
But yeah, like in the interest of providing you, the listener, with the most honest and journalistic view of trash cinema, as we always have sworn to do here on Movie Fighters, we are about to sit down and watch the 1 hour and 58 minute theatrical cut of Beastmaster.
Which may be the first time I've ever seen the actual theatrical cut of Beastmaster. I've seen it
certainly
100 times probably, but always. Which means
to fit on TNT, they had to cut like at least 10 minutes out of this movie.
Yeah. I always watch the TV edits of this movie, so this may be the first time I see it in widescreen.
Oh yeah, there's gonna be so much extra DAR.
So let's get that extra DAR. If you would like to watch along with us, you can head over to Amazon Prime if you have it and get some trivia, because there are 39 items of trivia in the Amazon X-ray function for Beastmaster. Before we watch the movie, though, Chris, it's time for the hottest segment in all of podcasting. It's time for Snack Situation.
That's right. Snack Situation!
What you snacking on? Chris, what are you snacking on for Beastmaster?
Well, Matt, it's the most, I guess not the most wonderful season, because that's Christmas, and it's not the second most wonderful season, because it's my birthday, August 12th, and it's not like the third most season, because that's probably Halloween / Spooktoberfest, but it's probably the fourth most wonderful season, which is Girl Scout cookie season. Girl Scout cookies are, if this was the Snack Situation standalone podcast and we were ranking these, top of the list, because Girl Scout cookies are, as a concept, are delicious. And, like, they might be the most morally sound snack ever. But yes, I have here a box of Girl Scout cookies given to me by my lovely wife. And they are my favorite variety. Matt, do you have a favorite variety of Girl Scout cookie? Can I guess what yours is?
You may.
Thin mints.
No. We talked about how we don't, both of us don't like mint stuff.
I know, I just wanted to, I do feel like it's a very hilarious insult to say that someone's favorite kind of Girl Scout cookies is Thin Mints. And all apologies to any of our listeners for whom that is true, but I do think it's very funny.
Including my own wife, who likes Thin Mints.
Does she really? I would have not picked Thin Mints for Marlene. Real guess for your favorite. Thanks a lot.
I do enjoy a thanks a lot.
Because you like shortbread.
I like just the regular shortbread. I like the trefoil, as it's known. Mm-hmm. But I do like the thanks-a-lots. I also am a big fan of the recent lemony cookies, which I don't remember the name of.
Oh, those are quite good. I think they're lemonades is the name of those.
Something like that. But I got to go with a classic for my favorite. And that is what in some regions is known as a caramel delight. And in other regions, it is known as a Samoa.
Oh, Matt, you're so basic.
What the? Whoa.
Everybody likes Samoas. Everybody likes caramel delights.
Because they're good.
Do you know what my favorite is? Surely we have talked about it in the 15 years that we've been doing this podcast.
I mean, I'm sure we probably have. Do you like a Do-Si-Do?
You got it. First guess. You got it. The peanut butter sandwich, aka the Do-Si-Do, that is my favorite Girl Scout cookie. Those Not the peanut butter patty. That's different. But the Do-Si-Do is delicious.
Yep, those are good. Oh, I guess the new addition this year is the s'mores cookies.
Ooh, I've heard those are good, too. Because usually, like, s'mores-flavored stuff tastes a little chemically. We've talked about that before.
It's because of the marshmallow.
Yeah. Man, you and me both are going to a con this weekend.
Yeah.
And there's a con in February that I'm not going to this year, but I've done it in the past in Charleston, South Carolina. And in the most brilliant move of all time, the local Girl Scout troop always sets up a table, and there are no discounts. They are full-price Girl Scout cookies start to finish at a three-day show. Hand over fist, Matt.
I mean,
they put fidget spinners to shame with how much they're pulling down at the cons.
It's an absolutely great business tactic to set up there. I'll say, yeah, the lemonades are the ones, the shortbread lemon icing cookies, and I like those. The Savannah Smiles are also good. They're the powdered sugar lemony ones.
Oh, God, I just want to go buy Girl Scout cookies now. Matt, what's your snack? We got to move on before I get too hungry.
Now, if I had been thinking ahead and knew that we were going to be doing Beastmaster for this episode, mm-hmm. I would have gotten a different kind of donut than I did. But Chris, let me ask you something. You know about donut happy hour?
I'm sorry. No, I don't.
All right. That's because you live in the eastern part of North Carolina, and I live in the western part of North Carolina, where we have a little grocery chain known as Ingles. If you speak Spanish, it looks like Ingles.
Mm-hmm.
And at Ingles, after 6 p.m. on a weeknight, they have a donut happy hour, where all their donuts from the day are half price. So you can get like a bag of three donuts for like $1. You just have to get it out of the case, and whatever's left in the case is what you get. So, you know, you might, it's not like everything, and it's, you know, it, they made it that morning, so it's not like the freshest it's going to be, but they knock off some of the price. So when I was at the grocery store earlier this evening, I was like, oh, I'm partaking in that donut happy hour.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I grabbed three things that I could find out of the donut case, and I should have gotten a bear claw, although I don't think there were any bear claws available. If I had known Beastmaster was what it was going to be, it would have been a bear claw. But what I have in front of me right now is a classic, absolutely classic lengthwise cruller that I'm going to be eating as we watch Beastmaster.
The phrase donut happy hour is wonderful.
Yeah. Doesn't it just make you smile?
It does. It makes me happy.
With all of that and our snacks in hand, we are going to fire up Beastmaster. As I said, you can join us if you have Amazon Prime. Just search up Beastmaster. It'll be there. And you can watch along with us. Either way, whether you watch along with us or not, we're going to take a little break. You're going to hear an ad and a musical interlude. And then we're going to come back and talk about the movie. And we are back from watching 1982's Beastmaster, which was a familiar experience, but in the harsh light of adulthood, definitely had...
Was exactly as good as you remember? Is that what you're about to say?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. There's just some weird stuff in this movie. There were multiple times where we both observed that Dar, the titular Beastmaster, is a weird dude.
Yeah, Dar's a really weird dude, is the thing. Like, Dar is... He's weird. He's just a really weird guy.
There are several times where it seems like he is going to be a mega creep.
I mean, he is.
There are also, like, lines that are just, like, fucking weird things to say.
Yeah, the plot of Beastmaster is extremely thin, and it's extremely well-worn. It is basically what you would do if you were making a fantasy movie and you didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on coming up with a plot. It's just your go with your instincts, also make sure he talks to ferrets at some point. But over the course of this movie, I think we had several really interesting discussions. So my question to you, Matt, is do we want to go through the discussions first and then hit the highlights of the plot, or plot first and then wrap everything up?
Let's do the highlights of the plot, because there's not that much to go through here. But there is something I want to talk about before we start talking about the plot, because it's relevant to the plot. And it's especially relevant to the very beginning of the movie. Because the first, like, 10 minutes of the movie hits you with these, like, multiple, like, weird allusions to either ancient myths or, like, Shakespearean stories.
It's very, like I said, it's very time-worn, I guess would be a good way to describe this plot. Because there's a lot of Conan in it, obviously.
Yeah.
Matt, you aptly pointed out that there's also a lot of Mad Max in it, a lot of Road Warrior. A little bit of Antigone, a little bit of Macbeth, a little bit of just like plain old hero's journey going on.
Yeah, you mentioned Antigone. There's some... just plain Oedipus in here. But in addition to that, there is the Bible, because the first thing that happens is that Mayax, played by Rip Torn, who is a high priest, receives a prophecy that he will be killed by the as yet unborn son of the current king, Zed. In defiance of this, he... attempts to have like a bunch of unborn children killed in the King Herod mold, right? On top of that, he is given the prophecy by three witches, which is straight out of Macbeth.
It's like it's the opening scene of the film. So it's very, very much the opening scene of Macbeth.
Yeah. So,
which, to be fair, is the Beastmaster of Shakespeare plays.
Not wrong. But, like, straight out of the gate, it's like, we're just cherry-picking stuff from other plays or other myths to make our own Beastmaster myth. Because, like, Oedipus is the whole, like, you will die by your son's hand thing, right? Mm-hmm. And they try to get rid of their son. Mm-hmm. And also the father goes blind in Oedipus, and it's just like, it's all there. Like, that happens in Beastmaster 2. Like, so Oedipus is all in there. Like, it's just like, hey, let's just throw a bunch of myths and also Conan and Road Warrior in this plot.
Matt, I think you're ignoring something obvious, which is that, as we know from Beastmaster 2 through the Portal of Time, the Beastmaster is... in our world, it is historical. It's not in some kind of fantasy dimension.
Dimension, yes.
You heard me. So technically, Beastmaster predates all of those things. It comes from an ancient time.
Well, as we said numerous times as we were watching this, that's just how it was back then.
It's just how it was back then. So we've got witches, and they've got their entire asses out. Here's a great thing about this movie. It's from 1982, so there's like brief nudity, like dudes getting killed all over. It is rated PG.
It is a totally PG.
There is, I believe, the same rating as Frozen.
Full out titty.
Yep.
In this.
Yep. And sure is.
It's PG.
So the first thing we see is these witches dancing around with their butts out, which is just fine. But they turn around. They got gross faces. What's up? What's up now? Cut that part out of TVS. I'll tell you that.
So Mayax reacts badly to this.
Mayax is Max with two A's, by the way. Just so you know for sure where we're getting all this.
Mayax decides that he's going to kidnap Zed's child and make it like a sacrifice, like a ritualistic religious sacrifice. Zed tries to stop this. Like, he basically runs up into Mayax's temple and says, "You're a zealot."
Yeah, and to his credit, Zed is like, it isn't just like, "Hey, you can't kill my son." Zed's like, "Hey, I've heard you've been doing child sacrifice, and that is not cool, so we're going to exile you."
Yeah. But one of the witches rolls up into the royal bedchamber. Somehow she just walks in there with a cow.
She does have a cow, and I was not... Does that come back at all?
Yeah, it's part of her plan. She has a cow. Somehow, through witchy magic power, she transfers the fetus from the queen to the womb of the cow. They escape. The queen dies? That is rather unclear.
I mean, she definitely does, because she's a mother in the first 5 minutes of a fantasy movie from the 80s, so she's gone. She's out of there.
Zed is left behind. The witch takes the cow out to, like, a field somewhere and cuts the womb of the cow open and takes out the baby, which was born not from a woman, but from a cow, which also seems like a weird Macbeth reference.
I don't know about Macbeth. I know it's like not of woman born and everything, but that's just like a weird, mythology thing, I think, because that's some the Minotaur stuff going on.
Yeah. The witch brands the baby with a mark on his hand, Ars mark, which is like the like the god of that oversees what Mayax is doing. And we talked about this, like, it's a big ass brand on the hand of a baby.
Yeah. It's like it would F up that baby's hand for permanent.
Yeah. So this villager sees the witch branding a baby and he's like, "Oh, that's fucked up." So he kills the witch and takes the little baby boy in as his own son.
And he is named Dar. Now, you might have noticed that our hero's name is Dar, the evil cult worships a god named Ar, and the whole thing takes place in Aruk?
Aruk, yeah.
And there's also going to be a tiger named Ra. So, like, the names are not great. I think.
And there are plenty of characters who don't get any names at all. Like, Dar's father does not get a name.
Yeah.
But they live in the village of Ymir, another great name. And the dad teaches the kid how to fight. There's a weird scene where their pal gets killed by a bear. Dar realizes he has special telepathic communication powers with animals when he makes the bear go away. Also, at this moment, I want to read a little bit of trivia from IMDb about the bear. The bear in this scene was a Russian bear, the only bear working in Hollywood at the time. As soon as he came out, the bear broke loose and attacked his handler. Sending the rest of the crew fleeing into nearby vehicles for safety. As soon as the bear was recaptured and the handler was carried off for medical attention, the crew turned to Mark Singer and told him that they were ready to film his scene.
We had, towards the end of this movie, we had a real discussion because one of Dar's animal sidekicks, Ruh, is a black tiger. And
who was actually just a regular orange and black striped tiger.
Did they paint him?
Yeah, they dyed him black.
That's really weird. But like, he's just kicking it no leash. And it's not like, it's 1982 in a movie that had a budget of $9 million. It's not like they're CGI-ing out the leash. There's just a tiger there.
Yeah. Yeah, just a straight-up tiger. I would be terrified the entire time having to be around a tiger. Kudos to Mark Singer for not looking terrified throughout this movie.
He kind of does.
Fair.
You can read it as kind of like absent, like not just... In fact, I think we can be very forgiving of Mark Singer's acting in this movie when you realize he did watch a bear maul a man and then yeah. did a scene with that bear. And then they were like, now here's a tiger.
Yeah. So Dar grows up and pretty much immediately his village gets ransacked and burned to the ground by the Jun. A horde of fanatic barbarians in league with Mayax.
You've seen Conan.
Yeah, sure. The yeah. Jun is where the Road Warrior influence really rears its head. Dar is the only person who survives the attack on the village. So he goes straight into superhero mode once he wants to have revenge for that attack, including his own father's death. He puts a kind of a tiara thing on his head, and he loses a lot of clothes.
Yeah, and at first he's wearing kind of a leather Xena skirt kind of thing, but in the next scene that's just a loincloth, and a loincloth it remains. And Mark Singer is cut in this movie. He's looking good, but he also does not look appreciably better than, like, dudes at the CrossFit gym I go to, right? Like he doesn't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Conan, but like that's what like hot muscle dudes looked like in the 80s.
Well, he's fit, but he doesn't have a lot of mass.
He doesn't. Yeah, he's very like I buy him as being more legitimately like in shape than because you know Arnold doesn't have cardio. Mark Singer looks like he's got cardio. But he doesn't, like, he's got no traps.
that was our body guy moment.
Am I wrong in any way, Matt?
You're not.
No, he doesn't have traps. He doesn't have, like, he's not chiseled, but he looks functional. And I appreciate that in a way that I, like, you don't see that in movies today. Everybody's just got a trainer. Everybody just looks like Magic Mike.
Everybody's got mass. Like
everybody's got mass.
Like Chris Pratt gets all muscly for his superhero movie, and he's got mass.
Uh huh.
You would think that at this point, Dar would be like on a collision course with Mayax, right? Like you would think he would be out for revenge, but he spends the next like half hour of the movie just hanging out in the woods.
Just fucking around the woods making animal friends, which I kind of love that. Because, you know, nobody wants vengeance all the time. You just have to chill out a little bit sometimes.
He is in shockingly good spirits for the next little bit of the movie, considering that he's, like, out for revenge, the death of his beloved adoptive father. But he meets his eagle named Sherek. He meets his black tiger friend, who he names Ra.
Ra.
And then he meets two ferrets, which he names Kodo and Podo, one of whom he named after his heroic dog, who saved him from the burning village earlier in the movie. Mm-hmm. It seems like the dog is more important than his dad is.
Well, the dog gets a name. Also, that is a cool dog. Also, the dog does die. In the movie. It's very sad. I thought he did have like a cool dog friend, but he does not. It's a tiger.
Yeah, the dog is only there for like the first maybe 20 minutes of the movie. There's a scene with some quicksand with the two ferrets, Kodo and Podo, mm-hmm. where the ferrets save him from quicksand, and then he has to save one of the ferrets from the quicksand. And after almost dying in quicksand, he is, again, in surprisingly high spirits. Also, it is not a movie from the 80s if there is not quicksand in it.
Oh, is it a John Mulaney bit where he talks about how he thought quicksand was going to be a real problem?
Yeah.
When he grew up?
I did too. It was in every movie.
Yeah, yeah. Also, he's like, these ferrets rather maliciously lead him into quicksand. And then he's like, you guys. Like his first thing is like, well, are you going to help me out? But then, like, he's very forgiving of this. So that's Kodo and Podo.
That's Kodo and Podo. Eventually, after meeting all these new animal friends, Dar runs into a young woman named Kiri, played by Tanya Roberts, who describes herself as a slave girl. There's a weird, creepy interaction between them. There's a thing where Ra, the black tiger, is like his wingman.
He works a pickup artist game with a tiger as his wingman.
Yeah.
Which is where we were like, oh, I don't remember Dar being a creep, but Dar's a creep. Because he like gets Ra to like go menace her, and then he's like, back, foul beast, and like winks at the tiger. And then he's like, I'll take this as my payment, and then like shoves his mouth at her. It's not great.
He finds some like whip marks on her, and she says she's a slave. He gets, you know, upset by that. It seems like there's more going on with her than she is saying. But she kind of like gets out of there pretty quick. Then he gets lost in his wandering around the woods, and there is a very strange dialogue-free sequence where he runs into this like race of like fish bird people.
Yeah, they're weird.
He frees a guy from a cage. The guy is immediately consumed by the fish bird people, who turn him into this like green goop. And then they see Sherak flying through the sky. They see that Sherak and Dar have a connection. So they're like, oh, you know a bird, so you're okay. And they give him an amulet. Like, they put an amulet on his sword.
You know a bird, you're okay. I think we can all agree that's a good way to judge people.
Yeah. Eventually, after a long time hanging out in the woods, Dar finally makes it to Uruk and finds that Mayax has totally taken over control of the city. King Zed is being held captive in a dungeon, and just mad child sacrifices are going on. There's a scene where Dar is like in a crowd. Mayax sacrifices one kid. Then they pull another kid out of the crowd, which I said, like, I don't want to victim blame or anything, but the dad who brought his daughter to this maybe should have known not to bring his kid to the child sacrifice show that was happening.
I think it was probably mandatory. I think we can go ahead and accept that.
Okay, sure. So the Mayax is holding up this little girl, about to throw her into a fire. He does, more or less, and she just kind of holds on and doesn't go directly into the fire. Dar summons the eagle again, Sherak, to come pull the girl out of the fire and save her. Somehow, in like the commotion that happens in all of this, Dar is able to get the little girl back to her dad at his house, and now he has like somebody on the inside of the city, this guy named Sako, who is like, hey, you saved my daughter, I'll help you out in any way I can. Then, in the midst of all of this, Dar meets two more people. A young boy named Tall, who's
ironically very short.
haha, who is another son of Zed's, so he would have been the prince. Another prince. And his bodyguard, Seth, who is played by John Amos, who I didn't mention in the top part of the show, but I should have, because John Amos had just come off a long run of being the dad on Good Times and having been in Roots to be in fucking Beastmaster.
He's also, like, jacked in this movie. He is thick with two C's.
He is, John Amos is definitely very thick in this movie. They are, you know, ready to take Mayax out of commission, but they want to do this the right way. Also, Seth informs Dar that his love interest, Kiri, is Zed's niece, which effectively makes Dar and Kiri cousins. It does not stop them from continuing to be love interests through the rest of the movie.
No, they do fuck.
They do fuck. So, they come together with a plan. They infiltrate a temple. They save Zed while escaping from these, like, beast-like men who were tortured into being like beasts. There's a whole sequence where they watch a guy get tortured and turn into this, like, mindless death guard, they call him.
Mm-hmm. They're like, yep, that's how he makes his soldiers, tortures them until they become beasts. And I'm like, I don't think that's, like, a great way to make soldiers.
Not really, but this is really the only part of the movie where those guys appear, too. So they save Zed. They regroup, and Zed's like, hey, motherfuckers, we're taking the city back. Beastmaster, Dar, is like, I'm not sure if that's how we want to go about this. Like, we can't just go running in headlong. We need an army to do this. And Zed's like, nope, we're taking it back right now. And you're a freak.
Yeah, Zed's a real dick.
He doesn't even recognize his own son.
Well, who, to be fair, was an unborn fetus last time he saw him.
Yeah, and now he's blind, so he can't see. He can't even see him at all. So Dar gets kicked out by Zed. He's like, get the fuck out of here. So Dar kind of goes like hangs out on a hill for a little while. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Zed's plan is totally fucked. And everybody gets captured. So Dar has to come back and save Kiri from being sacrificed, because she's about to be sacrificed. Save Zed from probably being killed also. And I think it's at around here that he reveals to Mayax that he was the child that Mayax was trying to kill at the beginning of the movie. I don't really know when Mayax learns that Dar is that person that was prophesied to kill him.
Yeah, it's like, he definitely knows by the end of the movie, probably by the time he gets killed. But there's so many tells. Like, he definitely sees the hand at one point, but I don't think he mentions it then.
Yeah, he acts like he doesn't see it if he does see it. So that part's weird. Anyway, Dar stabs Mayax, but Mayax, like so many other movie villains, isn't really dead. He comes back. He's about to throw Kiri into the fire, but good old Poto the ferret, sacrifices himself. Or I guess it's Kodo, not Poto.
It's Kodo. Poto survives. It's a real Monkey Joe tippy toe situation.
You're not wrong. Kodo jumps on to Mayax's back and sends him tumbling into the fire, thereby sacrificing himself. But that's not the end of the movie yet, because the Jun Horde has to show up and attack Arrok too. There's a big, long battle sequence at this point where the Jun are attacking. Things get a little dicey. There's a part where Dar burns most of the Juns alive. by using kind of a Molotov cocktail sort of thing. And then he uses his amulet that he got from the weird birdfish people to have them show up and kill any of the Jun that are left by turning them into goop.
Yeah, he definitely like what's the eagle's name?
Shrek.
Shrek. It's very hard to keep it all straight, Matt.
You're not wrong.
The eagle Shrek brings back the amulet, and Darth's like, "Yeah, awesome, back up." And then these horrifying leathery nightmare creatures are up from the ground and start eating people, and it becomes like fucking Phantasm for a minute. And then to his credit, like Dar and Seth and Tal and Kiri, like Dar like looks at him and is like, "We should leave." Like, they literally just bail when the shit gets weird, which I love.
It's very strange. Seth figures out that Dar is the actual oldest son of King Zedd. But Dar's like, just let Tal be king. And so Tal goes and climbs up the pyramid in the middle of town because he's going to be the new king boy, wearing less clothes than he should be wearing. That's pretty much the theme of this movie, people wearing less clothes than people normally wear. But the, like, little boy should definitely be wearing more clothes.
Yeah.
And then Dar, like, leaves to go on another adventure with Kiri and all his animal buds. And we learn that Poto has given birth to some new baby ferrets. That's the plot. That's the entirety of the plot of the movie.
Okay, so here's the discussions that we had. One, trying to figure out what you synthesize to get Dar in this movie. And I think we figured out that he's the exact midpoint between Luke Skywalker and Conan.
Now, I think we got Luke Skywalker because, for better or worse, Mark Singer sounds a lot like Mark Hamill.
He does sound a lot like Mark Hamill, but he also has that, like, you know, he's a farm boy. He's kind of put into this world. He's got destiny. There's weird father shit involved. Like, all that is an element of it. I think there's some Luke Skywalker in his DNA. The Conan thing is because Luke Skywalker doesn't fuck, and Conan fucks all the time.
Yeah, Conan does two things, and those are kill and fuck.
Yes. He's old Eros and Thanatos together at last in the form of Conan the Barbarian. Dar fucks, but he's weird about it. Like, very weird about it.
It's like there's a definite, like, not knowing what he's doing aspect to Dar. Like, Dar's kind of dumb.
Yeah, Dar's kind of dumb, which makes sense. He would be.
Yeah. He only knows what he knows.
He only knows what he knows. And, like, most of what he knows, he probably heard from ferrets.
That's true. Like there were a few times, I can't remember the exact moment where this happened, but there was one moment where I was just like, what the fuck is Dar doing? And I kind of was like, I think it seems like his father didn't raise him right.
The only parenting we see of Dar is when his dad is like, check out this cool blade style glaive that you can throw at other farmers. And then that honestly does not come back in the way that you want it to in this movie. It's no Krull in terms of glaive use.
You're right. The glaive ends up going to Tal in the end.
Yes.
Dar is like a teenage boy. Like, he never matures more than being a teenage boy.
Yeah. So the other discussion that we had was that there are not movies like this anymore. And if there are movies like this anymore, that's a thing I think we'd like to hear about.
Well, here's specifically what we mean when we say there aren't movies like this anymore. Because obviously there are schlocky movies. What we mean is there aren't low budget B fantasy and or action movies to speak of
that aren't ironic, that aren't like meant to be funny, that are genuine and made in this style.
Yeah, maybe the last one I can remember is a fucking Uwe Boll movie.
Yeah, like we were trying to, like, look, one of the things we were trying to figure out was who is today's Don Coscarelli? And our answer that we settled on was Don Coscarelli. Could roll up and make Beastmaster 4 and none of us would be surprised.
But In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege tale?
Uh-huh.
Is somewhere in here. Like, similar budget-wise, that movie was about $13 million. Beastmaster cost $9 million.
Yeah, well, but here's the thing about that, and I do want to run down a couple other people we talked about. We do, the Oscar nominations came out today, and so I mentioned Jordan Peele as that's a dude who could bust out Beastmaster 4, and we'd all be pretty excited. It's an important element to note that Don Coscarelli was like a working filmmaker. Like, this is post-Phantasm. Like, this is not a – like, this isn't an amateur project. Like, this is a very – like, for all of its flaws, it's a very professional movie, you know? For all the fact that a bear trainer was attacked by his bear on the set, it is a – there are actors in this, you know? Like, it's a real movie. You said that – the equivalent cost of this movie in 2018 dollars was around $20 million, right?
Yeah. Yeah, somewhere around $20 million.
Do you know what movie I recently saw that was made for $20 million?
What movie is that?
The Shape of Water.
Okay, but that's like okay. Movies with budgets like that now,
uh-huh,
are either like indie comedies, indie dramas, or like a certain type of prestige film, right? Mm-hmm. Most like outright fantasy action adventure kind of movies are these like big budget movies. And even like your like sci-fi originals, which you would expect to cover some of this territory, they're all that like ironic stuff. Like none of those sci-fi original movies are meant to be taken seriously.
There's no Pacific Rim equivalent in the Don Coscarelli oeuvre, you know, but I feel like The Shape of Water is a fantasy. Like, it's just a fantasy of 1962.
Yeah. I think it would be hard. You'd be hard pressed to say that The Shape of Water is a movie that's similar to this one.
Yes.
In any respect other than budget and maybe like in the loosest possible definition genre.
I just feel like there's not...
I guess the question is just, what happened to B cinema?
Yeah, and I think the answer is the video store died.
Because I guess.
I'm sure there are movies. There's, you know, we joke about there not being anything. We joked about it at the top of this show. We joked about how there's on streaming service. There's nothing we want to watch. But there's so much stuff on there. It's just stuff that, like, I'm never going to sit down and watch unless it's Christmas and the movie has the word Christmas in the title, in which case I will watch anything. But I'm sure that on – like, there are, like, literally Netflix original films that came and went without anybody talking about them because they, like – we all had to – we were all paying attention to Iron Fist at the time. And whether or not The Defenders was going to be any good. Like, and that's, there's stuff on there that maybe, that is where those type of movies would go now, but none of them are like this. They have the feel of a real movie. There's matte paintings and actors.
Yeah, the only genre where that can still happen, these kinds of movies still gets made, is horror.
Yes.
Horror can still do this, but these kinds of like adventure movies just don't get made anymore. And if they do, they're like the ironic version, the ironic sci-fi original version.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a bummer to think about that, to think about how like the only movies of this type you're going to get anymore are, like, you know, Jersey Shore Shark Attack, and not these like earnest but cheap Beastmaster style adventure movies.
Well, I think it's the, you see the same thing in television too, where it doesn't feel like there's a lot between like a Last Man Standing starring Tim Allen and like Game of Thrones, which costs like $46 million an episode or whatever it is, you know, like it, honestly, weirdly enough, it's one of the reasons I'm still like really into Power Rangers, because Power Rangers is kind of middling adventure television that occasionally is really bad and occasionally like really gets close to greatness. But it's, you know, where's today's Star Trek The Next Generation, a weird syndicated show? Like, is it all these shows on the CW Seed app that no one seems to ever watch? Because there's like 15 original TV shows on there.
Yeah, man, I don't know. Everybody's trying to do prestige TV now, though, and everybody's trying to do prestige movies. Like, all these indie dramas and comedies are like, they're all trying to avoid that sort of cheesy B-movie appearance. But I love that shit.
Yeah, and again, if you're sitting there yelling at your phone right now and going, "Hey, idiots, like, here's your middle budget adventure movie that still feels like a real movie but doesn't have like hugely famous current actors in it," tell us, for the love of God. I want to know. I really do.
Like, I feel like maybe there was an attempt. I mean, even though these were big budget movies, right? Like, Dracula Untold was a big budget movie.
Yeah.
Like, but maybe, I mean, like I, Frankenstein, like a movie that everybody just ignored.
Something separates those in my head from the Beastmasters of the world. And I will admit 40% of it is nostalgia, and I think another 58% of it is matte paintings.
Yeah, like the one huge difference is that all, like, even anything that's even kind of low budget is just going to rely on CGI to do fucking everything now.
Yeah. Hey, somebody make a movie with fucking matte paintings in it. How about that?
Chris, what are the high points of Beastmaster?
There's a part in this movie where I think it's right after Dar meets Seth and Tal, like he's got his cool tiger with him.
Yep.
And I think it's Tal is like, hey, is that your tiger? And Dar looks at Ruh and then looks back and goes, "We fight together sometimes," which is legitimately some of the coolest shit in the world. Please, next time you're out like walking a dog or like someone comes over and they see your cat and they ask if it's yours, that should be your response. "We fight together sometimes." So fucking rad.
"We fight together sometimes." What are some other high points in the movie? There's one part where Dar is like waving a big staff around.
Uh-huh.
Like there's a training sequence right after his village burns down, and that shit's pretty rad. There's also a part where
it looks like he uproots a tree and just like swings it around until he gets ripped.
Yeah, there's also a part where Tal and Seth both have staffs in their hands and they like spin them around in unison.
That shit's pretty dope.
Fucking great.
It's hard to talk about high points because this movie is setting out to be and mostly stays at serviceable. But, like, the stuff that it does good is fun. Like, Dar being a fucking weirdo is fully intentional and, like, really works well. Like, he genuinely means, like, yeah, I don't own this tiger. No one can own a tiger, man. But the way it comes out is delightful.
All right, let's do low points of Beastmaster.
So remember how I said that this movie just kind of sits at serviceable?
Yeah.
Yeah. The script of this movie is kind of bad. The plot of this movie is bad.
It's just thin. I think you were right when you described it as thin.
It's everything is the first choice you would make if you were making a ripoff of Conan.
I hesitate to say any actor in this movie is good enough to be a high point or bad enough to be a low point. If we're going back, if I can go back to high points for a second, I guess I would say John Amos is the closest actor to being a high point. He's really good in the movie.
He is quite good, yes.
The actor who I would say is maybe the low point is Rod Loomis, who plays Zed.
He's bad. What's that guy's name? Sacco?
Oh, yeah, Sacco.
That dude is also fairly atrocious.
Rip Torn knows exactly what kind of movie he's in.
He is, but he, like, could they have cast a less intimidating villain?
I mean, I think that's part of the idea, though. Like, if he was actually intimidating looking, then him sort of in a cowardly way, trying to kill children wouldn't make a lot of sense. The fact that he is Rip Torn is like, oh, obviously that guy would want to, like, kill a kid if there's a threat of a kid killing him. It makes him make more sense as a coward that he's Rip Torn.
He's no Tulsa Doom, for sure. And he's not quite slimy enough, you know? He's no Tulsa Doom. He's no Alan Rickman in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. He's just like, I feel like this movie should maybe be 20 minutes long and just like Dar walks up and just punches him in the face. And that's that. That's the end of that.
I will say this about as a low point for Beastmaster. We streamed this on Amazon Prime Video.
Mm-hmm.
I had it on the highest possible quality.
The H-est of D's.
And it was grainy as shit. Like, there has clearly been no HD transfer for Beastmaster. Like, no one has bothered to remaster Beastmaster. I don't think it's available on Blu-ray. I think it's only available on DVD. Where's that Blu-ray transfer? Give us that Blu-ray transfer.
Like, we demand it. Oh, also, there's a pretty low point in that they consistently refer to him as the Master of Beasts and not the Beastmaster.
All right, Chris, what are our final thoughts about Beastmaster?
This was like a familiar pair of shoes.
Comfortable.
Comfortable. A comfortable, comfortable trip into the Beastmaster.
Yes, I quite enjoyed watching this with you. And I had fun.
I also had fun. I think it's a good way to kick off 2018, to kind of reset a little bit, to actually ask some questions about the state of cinema on what is nominally a movie podcast, but is mostly just you and me getting increasingly angry and mystified.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to do. I want to point out some of the recommendations at the bottom of the page on Amazon. When you click over to the Beastmaster streaming video page,
mm-hmm.
Here's one. This is a movie from 1979, predating Beastmaster, Mistress of the Apes.
Oh, okay, that sounds great.
Here's the one that's really got me scratching my chin here.
Mm-hmm.
Ator, the Fighting Eagle.
Okay. All right. Now I'm looking at this cover, Matt. It looks like Ator the Fighting Eagle is not an eagle and is in fact a guy.
I think that is probably true. This was also released in 1982.
Is Ator the Fighting Eagle like the Beastmaster to Beastmaster's Conan?
Beats me. Like, it feels like it came out too quickly to be a ripoff of Beastmaster.
I mean, it could just be a parallel Conan ripoff, which it likely is.
Look, okay. This is the description of Ator the Fighting Eagle.
Oh, I'm reading it right now, Matt.
With training and guidance from a man named Griba, son of Torin learns his heritage and purpose in life to defeat the Spider King. He goes to the temple of the Ancient One to avenge the deaths of his fellow villagers and rescue his sister from the evil Dakar and his spider cult.
Hey, Matt, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
How much Keefe is in this movie?
Oh, Miles O'Keefe.
That's right. Hey, Matt, can I ask you another question?
Sure.
What are we watching in February?
It might be Ator the Fighting Eagle.
Yeah, I think, okay, Matt, I have decided right now, I'm sorry to make this unilateral decision, but I do have faith you will agree with me. It's fucking swords and sandals time. It's time to fantasy out. It is a genre we have ignored far too long. I think we're doing Beastmaster, we're doing Ator the Fighting Eagle, we're doing the Cole the Conqueror movie starring Kevin Sorbo and Tia Carrere.
All right, it's happening then. All right, next time on Movie Fighters, Ator the Fighting Eagle.
I do want to say one thing before we get out of here. You know that handshake move that you see a lot in like they do it in Hercules where they like, kind of grab the forearms? Seth and Dar do that, but they grab each other by the biceps.
It's weird.
It's bananas.
That's our first Movie Fighters for 2018. Our music is by Michael Kill. Our website was designed by Sean Bogus. The Snack Situation theme is by Matt Fisher. If you want to email us, you can do that at moviefighterscast@gmail.com. We're also on Tumblr at moviefighterscast.tumblr.com. We'll be back in February. We're going to watch Ator the Fighting Eagle, which seems to have the exact same plot as Beastmaster.
What if we just keep finding increasingly shitty movies with this plot?
We'll just keep an eye on those Amazon recommendations at the bottom of the page. See you next time, everybody.
Do we have a sign-off line on Movie Fighters?
I don't think we do.
We should get one.
We should get one.
Keep on popping that corn. No. That's really, that was bad. Bye, everybody. Have a great month.
This has been a Clytus Media production.